Welcome. This podcast is part of a special Priest Frequency series on rule of law in practice. It was produced through a collaboration between the United States Institute of Peace's Global Campus and IMPRO, the international network to promote the rule of law. The podcasts in this series collect and amplify the knowledge of IMPRO members, shedding light on key challenges to conducting rule of law reform in practice.
In each episode, we offer a snapshot of priority reform issues in developing and post-conflict countries. For this episode, we'll feature the second half of our interview with IMPRO's Rule of Law Research Forum facilitator, Christina Simeon. The first half of the interview covered research design for rule of law-related topics and can be found on the IMPRO website.
I'm Lelia Mooney, the director of IMPRO, and I'm also joined here today by my colleague Chelsea Dreher. In this podcast, we are exploring the topic of data collection in rule of law research and options for disseminating your research to maximize impact. Our expert interviewee is Christina Simeon, a valuable member of the IMPRO team and a longtime researcher with the Folke Bernadotte Academy in Sweden. Diving right in, Christina, I'd like to talk about data collection. IMPRO members tend to work in developing and conflict-affected countries where there are resource limitations and mobility restrictions. Can you tell us a bit more of the most challenging barriers that are out there when you're working and trying to collect data in these type of environments?
Thanks, Lelia. Great to be here again. I think some of the biggest challenges with collecting data in conflict-affected countries, especially, and also, of course, in some developing context, is probably related to security and access. Access may include access to research participants, as well as access to written documents, for example, applicable laws or case law. And also security challenges are, of course, a concern. For example, how do you implement a countrywide survey in a place like Afghanistan, where some areas might not have internet, telephone lines, or mail connection, and where security concerns hinders you from going to certain locations? In such case, it might be difficult to plan for a survey that covers the whole country. So then you might have to rethink your choices and, for example, focus on a specific region where security concerns are not as high and that you can visit more easily. Also, for example, if you want to, say you want to do an ethnographic study where you observe research participants very closely and embed yourself in that environment, access can be challenging. For example, if you want to do an ethnographic study of female police officers in Kabul, such access can be difficult unless you're actually another female police officer in Kabul. And this, the access, of course, also relates to security concerns for both for you and also for the participants in the research. But if we focus on access in this case, you know, it might not be possible to do an ethnographic study where you are seen with these group of people on a continuous basis, but you might be able to meet some of these police officers after work to do interviews, and then you can instead consider doing a case study that doesn't require the same detailed engagement with your research participants. In addition, of course, for access perspectives and access issues, it matters if you're doing research in a foreign country and whether whether you speak the local language or not. That's also an important thing to consider.
Could you maybe unpack for us some of the challenges of working across language barriers?
Sure. I think I just mentioned that not speaking local languages can be a challenge when you do research, but that, of course, depends on how you design the research and who you need to interview to answer the research problem and your research question. But I think that there are many challenges related to language barriers and translation, and I think they're more important than what is sometimes recognized. Foreign practitioners might not always be aware that the concepts that they bring in to a new setting might not have an obvious translation. Practitioners may also be using technical language that is difficult to understand, which can make local actors more reluctant to the research or the project. And, you know, a lot of things are not that easily translated, even if you have good interpreters and translators. Issues of translation can be about a lot more than just linguistics. And if you look at translation from a broader view, you see that it can also be about culture and translating concepts across cultures, and the way researchers interact with people in a local setting while doing so. For example, it might be a problem if in one culture it is acceptable to be very direct in their communication, and in the other, having a softer way of speaking is a sign of respect. How do you communicate a research project and conduct interviews in ways that do not upset the people you're communicating with in such a setting, for example? And I think it requires quite a lot of understanding of a setting to ensure that you're not upsetting people just by the way you're communicating. Also, finding translators and interpreters can often be quite difficult, especially when you're doing work with legal terms or international concepts that might not make much sense in local languages or might not have a natural translation. And I also think it's especially important to realize the value of good and well-educated interpreters and have a lot of respect for the profession, and make sure that you allow a lot of time for them to prepare, share material, you know, before you start the interviews, so that they can prepare for their job in a professional way.
We've talked a lot about research design and preparing for data collection, but when you actually get to the data collection process itself, what are some of the tools that you can use to help you along the way?
Well, you know, you do a lot of planning and research design, and that can all seem a bit time-consuming at times, but you also need to remember that that's an important part of the research. So even if the literature review takes a lot of time, you will benefit from that all through the research. Also, having a robust research plan with a well-defined research question is very useful when you come to more challenging parts of data collection. So the research methods are then the tools that you have available to collect the data that you need to, so that's the information you need to answer the problem you're trying to solve. So you need certain information, and as I mentioned previously, you might need information in numbers or in words. And as we talked about in part one of this podcast, qualitative methodology wants information in words, while quantitative methodology wants information in numbers. And some common qualitative research methods are document analysis, for example, of documents that you collect in the field. Also doing interviews in different forums is a very common method for collecting qualitative data. You could, for example, do group interviews or one-on-one interviews. It's always good to, I think interviews are a lot more challenging than most people recognize. And I think a lot of researchers or people who are conducting interviews might not be prepared or well enough prepared for the interview. So I think it's always, it's worth spending some time on getting prepared. For example, you could practice the interview questions with friends or colleagues. And it can be challenging to conduct interviews because people might not want to talk to you, or they might be really busy because they're working on a very hectic development program, or, you know, they have a lot to do at work. So then, you know, it's very good to have repeated the questions in your mind over and over again and sort of almost know them by heart. Also, you have to be aware of the complexity of the specific setting and make sure that you're not putting anybody at risk if they're seen conducting an interview with you, and making sure your research participants are comfortable with interviews is very important. And I think most researchers learn how to navigate the setting and how to be concerned about the security and you know, making sure that you're ethical in your use of research methods when you collect data. Another common, as I mentioned, qualitative research method is participant observation, and that's when you observe a specific event like a rule of law training or a conference, or groups of people like police officers. And this is nothing, you know, you should do undercover, and it's important that people are aware of your presence. So, you know, you're not supposed to do undercover observation and then release a report about discussions held at a meeting. You should always make your presence known and, again, be very respectful of the participants and their security. So if we move to quantitative research methods, one of the most common ones is the use of surveys to collect quantitative data. And here again, and maybe even more so because there's less room for adjustment, is it's very important to make sure the survey is well designed, with questions that are well designed and answering alternatives that are comprehensible. This is important because once the survey is distributed, you know, you want to make sure you don't get unclear answers because you designed questions in a bad way, and the survey takers do not understand the questions.
So, Christina, this is a very, very insightful conversation because it's a walk through the big park of how to conduct rule of law research by bridging and integrating qualitative and quantitative methods and methodologies, no? So in this big park, where there are lots of great tools for collecting data, once you have collected all that data, and once, of course, you've read your practitioner's guide, so what's next?
I think the most important thing when you're done with your data collection is getting to know your data. So at the end of the data collection, you'll sit there with hundreds of pages of written notes, or if you have tape recorded interviews, you'll have hundreds of hours of tape recording that you need to listen to and maybe transcribe. You might have hundreds or thousands of survey responses generated through an online survey provider like SurveyMonkey, or you might have handed out surveys and now you have those documents in front of you. It's important to stay organized, and I think this is something that people struggle with, especially if you have a lot of interview responses. But making sure your notes are well written, tidied up, and you keep track of everybody who you interviewed and their details is quite important. And you might also have to clean the data, and the practice of cleaning data can be explained with an example from quantitative methodology. So, for example, when you have distributed a survey, someone might have selected two replies instead of just one, or they have selected five categories instead of three. And so then you need to make sure that such responses are not counted before you start the analysis, because they will not provide a correct answer that you're after, because, for the obvious reason that if you're only supposed to answer one thing, then counting that one thing twice will leave the wrong picture of the data. After you have organized and cleaned the data, it's time to analyze the data. And an example from qualitative methodology is that if you, for example, have your interview responses, you read the replies and your notes a couple of times to get to know the data, and then you start to look for themes in the responses. So, for example, if one of my interview questions to rule of law practitioners is, what are some of the main challenges to your work in Myanmar? then maybe a common reply would be, one of the main challenges with my work is translation, because it's difficult to translate certain concepts into local languages. Then if I read my data and I see that several respondents have stated that that's their biggest challenge, then I have a theme. And I can code that as an issue of translation.
So thank you, Christina. And as we are getting to the end of this very interesting conversation, let me ask you, how are the next steps? How do we move this forward in disseminating the research? And how can this research, and we are assuming here that has been commissioned to external experts or run independently, or you yourself, how can the results of this research be integrated into influencing programming and making changes along the way? Because that's a question that is not always being addressed.
Oh, definitely. But I'll start with the first question. And I think this is a relevant question both for practitioners and academic researchers, because they view this a little bit differently and often have different approaches. The most common thing is, of course, to write up a research report. And then there are different ways of sharing that report. I think it's really important in the development field that we think about what we do with a report once it is written. So many times I've seen research reports that are put on a bookshelf, you know, and then nobody reads them again. And what's the point of the research then if nobody reads the report or use it to inform programming? The significance of the research is not that clear in such cases. And I think that if someone would come up with a way or implement a way to track the impact of research reports that are produced in the rural development field, that would be very interesting. So I think when you have a research report ready, it would be very good to make sure that you give seminars on the report, workshops, lectures where you discuss the findings, and where you engage with actors that have an interest in the research, and when you where you have an opportunity to comment on the research as well. And of course some big organizations like the World Bank do that with their major reports, but I'm thinking about smaller projects as well that you know, it's often important, and someone spent a lot of time on generating the research and writing the report, but then it might not get that much attention. Those are some ways we could interact with research participants and disseminate research findings if we make sure that they're invited to these seminars and workshops and lectures, etc. But you could also, you know, as a practitioner, try to look a bit broader and, you know, write an academic journal and try to bring in your practical experience to academic forums. And I think that's important because often practitioners stay in one field and academics in another. But I think it's important to reach that gap and get more practitioners to at least try to publish their work in academic journals or edited books. And of course, you could also write blogs, and there are a lot of resources out there on how to present your research findings in blogs. And maybe trying to engage more with media and ordinary news articles could be an idea. But I also think that the most important thing is to share the research with the people who live or who were in the community where the research was conducted, to be respondent to research participants and try to get back and present your findings, I think is very important. And also in relation to the knowledge that you gain from the research, it's important to think about how you can use that knowledge to help inform rule of law programming and the work that we do. And I think you can do that better if you attempt to communicate your findings with people in these settings. And, you know, especially if we have robust research, it can help inform that specific setting or help donors plan and carry out missions better. Also, if donors are open to change, then the best research can be used to change certain practices or approaches within an organization. So you can use the new information that come up as a way of managing knowledge and finding out new ways about how we could conduct rule of law programming a bit better.
Well, thank you so much, Christina, for joining us, and thank you for your time and insights. This has been an Improl Rule of Law and Practice podcast. If you'd like to learn more about rule of law research, please visit the Improl website at improl.org and take a look at Christina Simeon's guide.
Indeed. And thank you so much again for sharing all your knowledge, insights, and learning, Christina, with us and the audience. This audience of the Rule of Law podcast series that we are launching through the International Network to Promote the Rule of Law in partnership with the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus and Peace Frequency Radio.